You are listening to From the Margins on CHSR 97.9.
Aggressive state intervention into the local labor movement that ensures that the radical labor movements are marginal.
What they're looking for now is less to get elected and more to come to the favorable attention of capital.
For the first time in history, we have a movement in this country led by Indigenous peoples and, most importantly, Indigenous women.
Repeatedly we've seen the attempt to criminalize Black victims, to do anything to smear their names, to basically imply that Black life isn't worth anything.
Our society teaches women to be ashamed of their bodies, to hate their bodies, to change their bodies.
We see increasing organized repression.
I'm stubborn. I'm not going to back down. This could go on for years and years and years.
People need to realize what type of struggle that they're on.
The police, of course, want you to believe that there's some kind of criminal reason behind this.
Take every day as an act of resistance, whether it was a strike, a riot, or whatever.
It's very difficult for people to engage in sustained dissent. I don't believe it's impossible, though.
And hello, here we are on another lovely Sunday afternoon on From the Margins. Today on the show, got a couple of things, both very much related. And first up on the show, about unions in New Brunswick challenging the validity of these budget consultations that have been going on around the province. There have been 10, or will be by the time it's all said and done, 10 budget consultations that the government of New Brunswick is doing around the province. And it's really a follow-up from this document that was released at the end of 2015 called Choices in Moving Forward, where the government laid out what are our economic choices considering our financial constraints. That's the perspective they spun on it. And the choices were very much grounded in what to cut, where should we cut kind of thing. And that kind of reasoning has been heavily criticized by unions. So unions showed up at the event in Fredericton in quite a large number, union leaders and members, to oppose this budget consultation process, which they feel is flawed in that it's not true consultation. Partly you'll hear why. They'll explain why they think that. And the next part of the show will be an interview I did in the summer with a man named Richard Robbins, who's one of the authors. He's a co-author with Tim DiMuzio of a book called Debt as Power, and gets into a lot of the context of what is debt, what is austerity, and puts a lot of these considerations that you'll hear from the New Brunswick government about their concerns over debt and deficit, puts that in context, basically. So those are the two pieces coming up. So I'll start with, now I'll just describe the event. It was at the Fredericton Convention Center, and it was on January the 12th. So the event started out with a whole bunch of people outside. So you had mostly CUPE members and leaders that were outside with their signs and raising their concerns over what was going to happen on the inside, this what was called a consultation, which was happening a little too close to the budget to seem to have much possible effect on that budget. So people outside, so it starts off with me talking to a couple of people outside, and then eventually it'll move in, but we'll just go through it in that order. So here it is, outside of the convention center before the consultation.
Here now with Patrick Colford, President of the New Brunswick Federation of Labor. So Patrick, we're here at this public consultation in Fredericton regarding choices in moving forward in New Brunswick. What's wrong with this event?
Where do I start and how long is your radio show? Well, I guess on the surface what's wrong with this is, you know, we have these public consultations, so to speak, 2 or 3 weeks before the budget's set to come down. This is nothing more than a dog and pony show. So that the government can say we consulted the public. Anything that we're going to bring here, you know, that won't steer the conversation. You know, most of us are convinced the budget's already drafted. It just needs that rubber stamp on it. When I was in Bucktouche last night with over 200 of my members, and I talked to Minister Boudreau there, and he said, no, it's not done yet, and what have you. And I said, Victor, I'll be honest with you, it has to be. And he said, no, we're waiting. I said, there's no possible way the last public consultation will end on the 21st in Bathurst. That's a week, a little more than a week before the budgets come down. I said, unless you're going to work your staff to the bone to make these changes and to rewrite a budget, we're convinced that this is already set in stone.
So why would the government want to go around the province and do this exercise then?
Well, they made a promise to the public that they would, consult the public on the important choices. And as you'll see in here tonight, a lot of these questions are loaded. What would you rather cut? Well, we would rather not cut anything, truth be told. We've seen throughout the world that austerity doesn't work. So why does this province seem to think that austerity is going to work for us? And they've been selling the public on this, on the deficit and comparing it to a household budget. A government and household budgets aren't the same. They're not even close. We only need to look at the federal Liberals and what they're doing now with investing in infrastructure, creating those jobs from the bottom up. And we've had the Americans have done this for years also. And it's time that we follow suit.
So this document that they put together is called Choices in Moving Forward. And that preceded these series of events that we're seeing right now. Can you tell me a bit about this document and what was in it?
Basically, as the title of the document says, it's choices. And it comes down to, these are your choices. Would you rather cut here or would you rather cut here? Would you rather, pay more taxes here or less service here? So, and when you ask general public, do they want to pay taxes? I think most people know what the answer is to that. Nobody wants to pay more taxes. But then the other sense, you ask people what services they want to cut. But no one wants the services cut because for the most part, we don't feel that we're getting a fair shake of our services for what we pay in taxes. So, we've come with choices of a little more corporate tax. Stop with the corporate tax loopholes, the offshore accounts, to really make people pay their fair share. We brought forward a document on public auto insurance. This is sitting on a shelf somewhere in government. It'll be a revenue getter. We only need to look at other provinces and the revenue that they've got off of that. So it's quite simple. There are choices, but this government needs to make the right ones.
So essentially, there are other conversations that should be had that go well beyond what the government is doing here.
Definitely. Like I said, these questions are loaded, and it's a dog and pony show this time around.
So what do you plan to do with this event here?
Basically, what this event's going to be is we intend on going in, listen to the conversation. The most part, we don't intend on speaking because, quite frankly, we don't think that our suggestions are going to be heeded in any way. We've already gone through the dialogue session that formed this choices document, and very little of our suggestions ended up in this document, and we have attended every one of those. It seems very futile for us to really be involved in these things.
So what should New Brunswickers do?
Basically, New Brunswickers need to come out and have their voices heard. There's no mistake about that. But I think what's more important is for New Brunswickers to have their voices heard to say, if you're going to do a meaningful consultation, you cannot do this 2 or 3 weeks before the budget is to come down.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
My name is Norma Robinson. I'm the president of CUPE Local 1252, the New Brunswick Council of Hospital Unions, representing hospital workers, support staff, and paramedics in the province.
So what is your concern about this event?
Our concern is a year ago they had these public consultation meetings, and we gave them a lot of suggestions, we gave them a lot of information, and none of that came out in their choices document. Now, they'll tell you it did, but nothing that we told them came out in that choices document. So we're concerned that they are going to cut health care, they are going to cut education, they are going to cut roads. They're going to privatize things. They're going to take public tax dollars and put into privatization to sustain a service. Right now, we already have roads privatized by the private sector. Our own public sector can do it much cheaper and more effectively and more efficiently. But they don't seem to want to listen to us. They want to continue down that road of privatization. So that's what we're here tonight, is just to basically to show that we're not in agreement with their choices document, and to make them understand that there is choices they can make that will certainly sustain the province in the fiscal situation we're in.
And what about workers in the area that you're in? Have workers already faced cuts? Are they set to face cuts in the upcoming budget?
Yes, we already have sustained budget cuts. There's been, in my sector in healthcare, we've had ongoing cuts and reductions since 2011. They've restructured and restructured to the point where we're at a skeleton crew. We already have rural New Brunswick services that's been stripped away. They're making people travel further distances for services, which may be okay if you're young and viable and you have a car. But what if you're a senior citizen? We're in an aging population in New Brunswick where we don't always have family that can take us to these appointments. And if I've got to travel 2 hours to a healthcare facility because they're talking about closing hospitals, then that's not acceptable to the seniors in this province. So yes, we've seen cuts, and we feel that if this budget comes forward with their choices document, we're going to sustain even further cuts. The cuts are going to get much deeper.
So you think that as far as the government's suggested choices, that there's a lack of priority on the accessibility to healthcare in there?
Right now, if the accessibility to healthcare, in our mind, in public's mind, because this is, you have to speak to the public on this as well, we feel it is sufficient. There is access to public healthcare. If they start closing 10 hospitals in this province, or if they start cutting education where kids are on school buses for 2 hours a day to get to a school, if they continue to privatize roads where the snow removal is not done in a timely manner, there's going to be detrimental effects of that on the citizens of New Brunswick. And we think that their choices document is that's the road they're going down. They're not looking at where they need to look. They've never looked at corporate taxes. They need to increase, make the people that make millions and millions of dollars a year pay a fairer taxation. They need to look at different things that they could potentially put in place that is not going to affect the livelihood of services, public services in this province. We cannot erode the public service any further.
And this event here tonight, what is your plan on how to interact with this event tonight?
We're here tonight just as a friendly demonstration, just to show them that we are not in agreement. They didn't listen to us before, so as far as engaging with them, that is not our intent. Our intent is to be there to show our presence, to show our dissatisfaction in their decisions and choices they are making, and just to show them that we are watching. We are watching, and we will be making more noise.
Right. I guess one final point. This is a consultation session, what they're calling it, is happening so soon before the budget. And I've already heard that it seems a little odd that it would be happening right before the budget, as if it could actually have an impact on it with this little time. What is your thought on what the whole point of this exercise is?
This exercise is for the government to get the buy-in, for them to basically say to the public, we met you, we gave you the opportunity to come and say what you wanted to say. You're absolutely right. There is no opportunity or no time between now and the budget for them to actually digest what they're going to hear at these meetings and come back and make changes. I believe that the choices is already made. I believe that this government is only trying to make the public and taxpayers realize you had the choice to come out, and if you didn't, they're putting all the blame back on the citizens of New Brunswick. When in actual fact, should we be telling a government how to do their job? Should we actually be telling educated people how to do their job, or should they be doing it?
All right, so you heard from Patrick Colford, president of the New Brunswick Federation of Labor, and then Norma Robertson, who's president of basically a group of hospital workers in the province. Okay, so that was before people went into the event. And once people went inside into the building, they went in with their signs. There was a lot of people with signs in. And at that point, right before the entrance to the conference hall, people were told, don't bring your signs in. Of course, people did bring in signs. And anyway, people went inside, and then people were standing around the room in a circle towards the back of the room and to the sides of the room against the wall. And people in the middle of the room, there was quite a number of tables and people were sitting at the tables. And there was a bunch of documents, and like, they're the same document at each table. And it was designed to engage the people there to give their ideas based on the suggestions that were given. What were their favorite choices of these possible cuts and privatizations and or what have you? Next up is going to be Victor Boudreau, who will get into what this document's about, as well as choices moving forward, as well as the event. So he's setting it up. So this is Finance Minister Victor Boudreau. Thought it was a good measure to put this in as well. And I'll break this up into a couple pieces. You'll hear the first minute and a half of it, and then I just have a comment on that, and then we'll follow up with the rest of it. So here we go with that. Victor Boudreau, Minister of Finance for New Brunswick.
It's not news that New Brunswick is facing serious demographic and fiscal challenges. Without action, our province faces mounting debt, our credit rating could be downgraded, and our interest costs could go up. If we don't act now, we will risk our ability to invest in priorities such as job creation, supporting families, and by protecting health care and education and helping our most vulnerable. Nous ne pouvons pas continuer à faire comme à l'habitude. Nous devons nous assurer que les services que nous offrons répondent aux besoins actuels et futurs des Néo-Brunswickois. These challenges are not new, and we are not the first government to sound the alarm bell. But until now, no one has really heeded that alarm. The inability for a government to balance the books since 2007 means the problem has compounded. Think about that. Since 2007, no small business, no family budget could continue for 8 consecutive years in a deficit situation. Well, neither can the province. Our debt has increased significantly over the past decade, as has the cost of servicing that debt. We now spend, in this fiscal year, $685 million per year just in interest on our debt. Not paying it off, just paying interest. $685 million, and that's at record low interest rates. To put that in perspective, we are now spending more on servicing the debt than we are investing in post-secondary education.
All right, so that's the point. I'm going to cut it just to intercede with some other content here. He was talking a lot about how, well, New Brunswick is paying a ton of money every year to pay off this interest on their debt. This is a very interesting situation that has come up in general across Canada. There is set to be a lawsuit, I believe, sometime this year. Of course, these things are hard to predict on exact timing. But Rocco Galati, who is a constitutional lawyer based in Ontario, is taking the case on, and it will be about this interest that you have governments paying interest to private institutions because that's where the loans are coming from. And this isn't something that's been like it this all along. Things have changed. In 1974, the Liberal government of Pierre Trudeau, you know, Justin's father, was basically coerced in a way, or convinced, let's just put it that way, it's probably better, into joining the Bank for International Settlements, or the BIS, which is a private Swiss bank which oversees private central banks basically around the world. And there's an article recently in a piece of media called The Watershed Sentinel, and that's where I got this information. They quoted another paper, which is called the TAI, which is based in British Columbia. And in a comment on April 17th of last year, where some news about this upcoming lawsuit was hitting the media, they had this to say. The BIS's new Basel Committee, supposedly in order to establish global financial stability, encouraged governments to borrow from private lenders and end the practice of borrowing interest-free from their own central banks. The rationale was thin from the start. The central bank borrowing was and is no more inflationary than borrowing through the private banks. The only difference was that private banks were given the legal right to fleece Canadians. In other words, Canadians end up paying interest through the government cutting services, through the government privatizing. All these costs are essentially downloaded onto people, and these payments, these interest payments, end up going to private institutions. So this is the subject of the lawsuit. Is this constitutional that this is taking place? And this is sounds like it's going to perhaps start this year. Again, unpredictable in those when it comes to lawsuits. Something to think about, interest payments. When the government is talking about how much money it's costing us, the province, to service the debt, they're largely talking about these interest payments which are going to private institutions. So here's the rest of what Victor Boudreau had to say.
We have to think about that for a minute. The combined budgets of environment and local government, energy, agriculture, aquaculture and fisheries, tourism, heritage and culture, public safety and justice do not add up to what we spend annually on interest for our debt. Notre gouvernement s'est engagé à rétablir l'équilibre des finances de la province et nous avons commencé à redresser la situation financière dès notre premier jour au pouvoir et nous avons fait des choix difficiles au cours de la dernière année. Some of the actions already taken in our first budget, and some of them were part of the video, but Premier Gallant taking a 15% pay cut, ministers taking a 10% pay cut, continuing to freeze MLA's salaries for the eighth consecutive year, reducing the number of deputy ministers, the most senior rank in the bureaucracy, by nearly one-third, freezing to 2014-15 funding levels all the officers of the Legislative Assembly, centralizing some government services, including communications, inspections, and enforcement, and continuing to implement process improvements to eliminate waste within government. Récemment, nous avons publié le rapport des choix pour remettre le Nouveau-Brunswick en marche, afin de renseigner la population du Nouveau-Brunswick sur les choix qui s'offrent au gouvernement et de faire preuve de transparence quant aux choix qui sont envisagés. You may not agree on all the initiatives contained in the choices report. These are choices for consideration. If you add them all up, they would account for approximately $1 billion. We need to do approximately half of what's in that report. And as we've pointed out, there are really six key initiatives, the bigger initiatives, but that we certainly have to pay attention to. But there are a total of 32 choices in the report. But the six more significant ones are reshaping the civil service, reducing spending on health care, reducing spending on education, increasing the harmonized sales tax, increasing the corporate income tax, and introducing highway tolls. So this is your opportunity to have input on these difficult choices before us. Voici votre chance de vous prononcer sur les choix difficiles auxquels nous sommes affrontés. We need to strike the correct balance between revenue and spending measures while also recognizing the need to grow our economy and invest in our priorities. We must also ensure fairness, that is, that no one region or no one segment of the population is unduly targeted. The choices we make together will serve as the foundation for a province where we can invest in priorities such as healthcare and education. But before we can dream about investing surpluses, we need to get there. We need to get to that situation. And by addressing our finances now, we will be setting the right conditions for creating jobs and growing our economy. We have no intention of doing this again next year or the year after that. We are going to fix our finances through this process once and for all. Then we want to turn the page and we want to be able to focus on more constructive, more positive discussions and not continuously have to have this discussion around cuts and reductions and closures. But we need to get it right the first time. Over the next couple of weeks, we will continue our consultations with New Brunswickers. No decisions are final yet. However, unless New Brunswickers convince us otherwise, our government's goal, after listening for the past number of months, and you would have heard or read the Premier's remarks today, we will protect. Our government has made the commitment to protect health care and education because we have heard that over the last number of months. But that doesn't mean that the work stops. There are still decisions that have to be made. There are still choices in that choices document that need to be acted on. So what we're asking you here this evening, you know, it's easy to talk about the choices you don't want to make, but you have to share with us the choices that you are prepared to make, that you are prepared to live with, so that we can address this fiscal challenge. Alors, merci d'être ici ce soir pour prendre part dans ces discussions qui affecteront sans doute l'avenir de notre province. Thank you all for being here this evening and for taking part in these important discussions affecting the future of our province. Thank you.
All right, so that was Victor Boudreau, who is the Minister of Finance for New Brunswick, and that was his 5-minute or thereabouts comment at the start of this public consultation event. At least that's what it was called. And after this speech was done, at that point, there was probably about maybe 15 or 20 minutes of the people that were standing around the back, the QP union members and leaders predominantly. There was other supporters there. Members and leaders of other unions were there as well. The president of the New Brunswick Federation of Labor was there. So standing around the sides of the room. And at some point, a chant started. You say cut back, we say fight back. And at that point, people walked around in a circle like a picket and then were eventually ushered out of the room. So that was the end of the event for the people who came there to oppose it. And then went on outside of the room and down the stairs into the foyer area of the Fredericton Convention Center, where there was some more commentary from a couple of more of union leaders about how the event went and some thoughts. So next up is that.
Secretary Treasurer of QP New Brunswick, Minerva Perel.
So we were here in a silent protest to not partake this time, not give them our ideas, but to stand up against the walls and stand up for our public services. And that's what you've done tonight. You've done wonderful. Across the province for the rest of the month, we're going to be doing other forms of actions at these consultation meetings. One of the reasons we don't want to get too disruptive is we don't want to get thrown out of them altogether. We want to be able to stand up against the walls, and we want to be able to show them our signs and our voice that we are speaking out for public services. We're going to continue to take these actions, and once again, I thank you from all the members that are coming out, the frontline workers. We as leaders can come out and do this any day. Your provincial presidents can come out, and we do this any day, but we need you, the members, to come out and speak for your jobs and show them your voice. And you've done that tonight, even if it was silent protest. Awesome. Great job.
Norma Robertson.
Just to carry on where Minerva left off, this government, I had a conversation before I went in with one of the MLAs. We had a conversation upstairs. It's very obvious they find every excuse they can to continue on with their choices. The message tonight, I was at the meeting last night in Bucktoosh. It was really interesting because Victor Boudreau tonight said something different here than he said in Bucktoosh last night with respect to education and health care. You can tell we made a point last night in Bucktoosh because they didn't stop us from taking anything in. Tonight, they wouldn't let us take our signs in. I'm sorry, we own the province. It's our tax dollars that fills this province. It's our services that we provide the service to the people upstairs in that room. Don't for 1 minute think that the public is not on our side, because people sitting up there in that room are just as frustrated as you are about losing any valuable service. We can't have any service eroded any further. You are a really great group for coming out here tonight and showing this government that you are not in agreement with what they are proposing. As Minerva said, if we get in discussions, it looks like we are in agreement with what they're putting forward up there. By us doing a silent protest, it speaks volumes to say we are not in agreement with the choices document at all. So this is why we did what we did. And before me closing, I just want to thank the hospital workers that came out, as well as the paramedics, and all the members that came here tonight to represent QP in this province. And we just need to mobilize as we go and keep this momentum going. And if you have family members, friends, people on your Facebook, get them out in the other communities. There's a meeting tomorrow night in St. John. There's one in Grand Falls Thursday night. And just, you can go on the government website to see the list of meetings. We need to keep the momentum going and get as many people as possible at those meetings.
Patrick Colford.
The only thing that I want to say is I want to thank everyone who came out here tonight. It's very important, I think, for us to be there, to stand there, to be silent, to watch them. And I think that's the message that we really want to send here. Because unions for centuries have been the social watchdog. And that's what we've always done. And I think it's very important that we play that off, that we're not going to take part in this, because quite frankly, a lot of us believe that it's already done. But we're going to watch over you and ensure that as soon as you step over that line, we're there to push you back. and it needs to be that way and not the other way around. So thank you very much for everyone coming out.
If I can just... There's one thing I don't want...
All right, and that's that for all the commentary that I recorded from that event. I guess one little point earlier in that piece, the last part you just heard, there was Norma Robertson who talked about we own the province, meaning, of course, the people of the province own the services. Essentially, they own the government, at least theoretically. Some may argue Irving owns the government, but that's a subject for another show. I think it's important to point out that as far as the land goes, the land in New Brunswick, including the water, is actually not owned by anyone except the Wollastook people and the Mi'kmaq people who never ceded their land. So, but just thought I'd put in that caveat. It's important to always be reminded of that. Okay, so next up, we're going to go to a song break before we go to Richard Robbins. Richard Robbins, as I'll give a little intro to that before I put him on, the author of Debt as Power. But let's listen to... let's listen to something more musical here. This is Wall Street. Love that song. That's Wall Street by Jack Feels Fine. All right, now moving on to some American context. So, hey, Wall Street's a good segue to that. This next piece you'll hear is Richard Robbins. I did an interview with him over the summer. He's the author, along with co-author Tim DiMuzio, of a book, Debt as Power, which is a new book out this year. And this book is really about debt. It's about austerity. So a lot of what you heard Victor Boudreau NB Finance Minister talking about, this idea of the necessity of cutting, how it must be done because we must service the debt, we must pay these interest payments and all that. Well, this puts that into a bit of perspective and points out that it doesn't really have to happen that way, it totally depends on decisions made about how the whole economy is run, etc. So here is Richard Robbins speaking about these subjects. So, Richard, the title of your new book is Debt as Power. Can you elaborate on what that means and generally what's the book about?
Well, when my co-author and I, Tim DiMuzio, took a look at the global economy, it was pretty clear that essentially the global economy is a debt economy. That is, it's quite literally built on debt. And we wanted to find out how that happened, what the history of it was, how did it come to be like that, and so on and so forth. I mean, just as an example, there are about $225 trillion in assets in the global economy. That's an enormous amount. I mean, it's hard to conceptualize what a trillion is. Yet, some 80% of those are debt instruments. That is money, essentially, that assets accounted in some form of debt, either securitized debt such as mortgages or car loans, unsecuritized debt such as credit cards, so on and so forth. And only 20% is what we consider ownership, say, in stocks and things. And if you look at that, you realize, well, we have a debt economy, and what we wanted to look at is how that came to be, and then I think more importantly, what the consequences were. Now, debt historically has always been seen as a form of power. Uh-huh. People who are indebted, obviously owe something to somebody, and the creditor has power over the debtor. And that's been, something throughout history. David Graeber, in a terrific book called Debt, a 5,000-Year History, traces that. And, so clearly it's always been that. The question is, how has it come to be the prime source of power in today's world, both, globally and within countries? And so we wanted to better understand what happened and how that came to be.
Mm. So what about capitalism, the economic system we're living in, and debt? What is the relationship between the two?
Well, two things about that. I think one, as I mentioned before, if you look at capitalism as capital, of course, as wealth, now, as I said, over 80% of wealth in the global economy is debt, and so you really can't consider capitalism without taking a very, very close look at debt. The only thing I'd add to that is I've come to be try to avoid the term capitalism. It's become too easy a term to throw around. And I think it very often gets confused with the market economy, as Adam Smith described it in Wealth of Nations. And I think we have to make that kind of separation. And that's important for me because I think the book itself is not an attack on the market. We don't see anything wrong, I think, with people buying and selling things. The problem is with the financial system we've evolved, that we think most of the problems we associate with capitalism come from. So on the one hand, I mean, you can't consider capitalism as we understand it without considering debt. And secondly, I think we have to be a little careful we don't confuse capitalism with a market economy, because there is, I think, a difference between them.
How would you describe that difference?
Well, capitalism, to a great extent, is making money with money, is one definition of it. Although people rarely, I think, are very careful in terms of how they define the term. And making money with money, essentially, is a financial system we've evolved that has created a lot of the problems that we have. But my point is, you can have a market economy, but you don't have to have one in which debt is the central ingredient. And secondly, you don't have to have a market economy where, as we see it, and this is probably the most important part of the book, that money is something that's lent into existence, because that's how we create money. Economists, for some reason, don't generally talk about this. If you look at a typical economics textbook, they'll mention money, simply say it's a store of value, a means of exchange, a means of valuation, and then dismiss it, sort of equating it with things like cowrie shells or cattle or something in other societies. What they almost never consider is how we create money. That is, how does it come into existence? And in our economy, and this is something we trace historically, it comes into existence through loans, through debt. And that becomes what we think is a central thing you have to consider when you look at the modern economy.
So in a sense, this drives the creation of debt.
It drives the creation of debt. And once you understand that money is lent into existence, And then you realize that, you know, there's about $200 trillion in debt right now globally in our economy. You begin to understand that you have to understand the dynamics of that. Put it another way, there's $200 trillion of debt, which has been lent into the economy, essentially. And over the next 10 years, just as an example, that money has to generate another $50 trillion in interest. In other words, when money is created by banks, by lending it into existence, they create the principal, they don't create the interest. And the question that becomes very important is, you know, how do you create that interest? And secondly, where does it go? And once you understand and look at those questions, our economy takes on a very different tenor. One of the things you understand is that everything we know about our economy changes. Concepts such as economic growth, austerity, which you talked about recently on one of your shows, energy, inflation, all become something very different than the way people usually understand the terms.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that subject of debt and austerity. When we have governments talking about, you know, the difficult fiscal situation and tightening belts, and this is in response to these big deficits. So I was wondering if you could explain this concept of deficit, government deficits, and austerity, how that leads to austerity.
Well, let me get back into the idea of again, money being lent into existence. One of the things we do, I say, we look at it historically. And where it really begins was with the creation of the Bank of England, where essentially private interests, the governors of the Bank of England, were given the right to create money and create it by simply lending it out. They did that in exchange for a loan to the British Crown that was heavily in debt because of wars. And that system then became the general way that finances and money function in the modern economy. You have a central bank. The central bank essentially lends money to the government that becomes the so-called national debt. And that debt on the books of the central banks becomes an asset, which they distribute then to other banks in the system. Those banks then lend out the money at interest, and again, money simply, you know, comes into the economy in that way. I mean, to give you just a Canadian example, you know, since 1968, the amount of money in the Canadian economy has increased over 4,000%. Again, where does that money come from? And it comes largely from banks, essentially creating credit lines on people's bank accounts, simply lending it into existence. And essentially, it comes out of thin air. You know, different ways of different. Always been very different theories about how banks did this. You know, one common theory was that people make deposits, and then the banks lend out those deposits to other people. It's a Wonderful Life. If you remember that Jimmy Stewart movie,
yes,
kind of framework. But again, banks lend far, far more than they take in. You know, in assets. The other theory is that banks hold something in reserve and then can lend out about, you know, 90% essentially of, in excess of what they have. But again, recent studies show that no, banks simply, you know, create the money out of thin air. And that's an enormous power because most of these banks, the vast majority, are private enterprises. So essentially what we did, starting with the Bank of England, is we assigned to private interests the right to simply create money out of thin air and to collect the interest on those loans. And one of the things I say we rarely consider is, you know, how do we do that? How do we, who goes out and creates this interest, which is not lent, and, you know, where does it go, you know, once it's paid? And I think once you understand that, you get at the root of a lot of our problems, environmental problems, problems of inequality, problems of concentration of power. We think all stem from this very basic idea of handing to private interests simply the right to create money and to collect interest on that.
What about the government deficit? Like, why is it that governments are always talking about being in deficit and having to go to austerity to resolve the deficit?
Well, that's complicated. Let me kind of, I have to digress a little bit to get that. First of all, again, the national debt, which is, again, the borrowing, essentially, that the government does from the central bank, that debt becomes the base money supply. In other words, when the central bank lends money to the government, and the government then owes money back, that money that it's owed back counts as an asset for the central bank, which it can then distribute to other banks. If you actually did away with the national debt, and by the way, the national debt of England has never been repaid, if you ever repaid it, you'd have no money. Mm. Because that's essentially the way money begins. Now, this, again, has a lot of implications. And one of those is this whole idea of reducing the national debt. And why do you want to reduce the national debt? And the only reason you want to reduce the national debt, essentially, is to keep money scarce. And the only reason you want to keep money scarce is so that it retains its value. Now, I mentioned that economics textbooks, you know, treat money as having different functions, two of which are a store of value and a means of exchange. Now, these are contradictory functions. Because essentially, if you want to maintain money as a store of value, which is, by the way, the prime, if not the only goal of central banks, you want to be able to control inflation. You want to keep the money relatively scarce, and so it maintains its value. On the other hand, when you do that, you reduce the amount of money in circulation, and you cut back on money as a means of exchange. Because the more money is a means of exchange, the more economic activity, the more jobs created, and so on and so forth. So central banks have this problem. On the one hand, they want to keep it as a store of value, meaning keep inflation low. On the other hand, they want to have enough money in the economy so that people can get jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And when you realize that the goal of almost all central banks, I think the U.S. Central Bank is the only, the U.S. Federal Reserve is the only exception, their only goal is to maintain inflation, to keep inflation low. And the only people who have a vested interest in that are people with a lot of money who want that money to maintain its value. So, you know, we talk about inflation, which essentially you're talking about is keeping money scarce. That's why in the U.S., if unemployment fell below a certain level, fell below 5%, the Federal Reserve would immediately raise interest rates to reduce the amount of money in circulation, because it was feared the more people who worked, the more they'd spend, and the more they'd spend, the more money would lose its value through inflation. But again, you know, to simplify that just a little bit, it boils down when you get to, again, you know, national debt. National debts are not terribly important in the sense that national debts are simply are based on the power of a state to tax its citizens. That's all it is. Mm. So what the Bank of England did was essentially create a national debt. They did it on the basis of the fact that the crown could impose taxes on the citizens to repay that debt. So nations, again, have all kinds of ways that they can, you know, repay that debt. But by repaying that debt, they reduce economic activity and reduce the supply of money. So when you hear people talk about, you know, reducing the national debt, what you're getting at really is a misunderstanding of one, the function of money, and two, how money, in fact, is created, and how the national debt is the base money supply.
Is it fair to say, then, that when governments are screaming about the deficit crisis, it's not nearly the emergency that they make it out to be?
Well, it's an emergency for those with a lot of money, and it's an emergency for banks. Because the one thing that banks fear, of course, is inflation. To give you an idea of what could happen with that, going back to the 1970s in the United States, we have very, very rapid inflation in the U.S. over that period of time. If I borrowed $100 in 1970 over 10 years, the money that I would pay back to the banks would be $50 because the value of the money decreased by about 50%. Now, banks don't like that, and so they want to make sure that they can lend and get back money that's worth the same or more than what they lent out. So there are portions of the certainly the financial system fear inflation. For most people, inflation is good because it makes it easier to pay off their debts. In fact, one way in which countries have managed to pay off their debts is simply inflate the debt away, where the money they owe becomes worth far less than the money they in fact borrowed. So when you look at you know, the national debt controlling inflation and things like that, you have to see, okay, in whose interest is inflation being controlled? In whose interest is the money supply being made scarcer by paying down national debts? And essentially what you come to is it's in the interest of essentially the 1%, those people who hold most of the money, most of the assets. For everybody else, inflation to some extent is good. The IMF has even, you know, proposed occasionally letting inflation run higher in indebted countries to make it easier for them to repay their debts. But generally, you know, no one paid too much attention to that.
And what we're seeing a lot of, in Canada, in the U.S., and throughout Europe and countries everywhere, the banner of austerity, governments are mm-hmm. Responding to what they call the deficit crises, debt crises, and imposing austerity. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about what it's meant to accomplish.
Well, I have to digress just a little bit to explain that. One of the consequences of lending money as creating money as debt, and then again as interest-bearing debt, is, and probably the most, for me anyway, the most important consequence of this, is that it gets you into an economy in which you have to have perpetual economic growth. Now, we call it economic growth, and in reality, what you're talking about really is capital accumulation. And again, another thing that economists almost totally ignore is, you know, why do we have to keep growing? You and I have to spend more this year than last, more next year than this, in perpetuity. In fact, the economy has to grow at a minimum of about 3% a year. And if you look at all studies on well-being and happiness and things like that, you find that, you know, that increases virtually not at all with the increase in money. But nevertheless, the economy has to keep growing. Now, there's a lot written about that, and a lot written about how this is not a good thing, that we simply can't grow in perpetuity. I mean, if we grew at 3% a year, globally, the economy in the year 2100 would have to be a quadrillion-dollar economy. Now, environmentalists will tell you that even if our economy stayed in its present state, you know, the world would be virtually uninhabitable, by 2100. So one question we ask is, well, how do we get trapped into the situation where we have to keep growing every single year? And the reason is simply because that represents the interest on the debt that is owed to lenders, based upon the principle that they, in effect, lent out. Now, perpetual growth, which, again, is in fact the main goal of modern field of economics. If you look at an economics textbook, it'll list the things that economists have to be concerned about, and the prime one is economic growth. Nobody ever really says, oh, we can't grow anymore. A politician who said that would be kicked out of office immediately. So economic growth becomes the main thing. Now, in truth, if the economy stopped growing, then you have an economic crisis, as we did in 2007, 2008. Because if, in fact, the economy stops growing, that means essentially means that the interest, profit, et cetera, on what's lent out and invested cannot be realized. People can't repay their debts. And so you have an economic collapse. So we're sort of trapped in this situation where growth is simply unsustainable on the one hand, but if you don't do it, the economy collapses. So that's a difficult problem. Now, the other aspect of that, this will get us to the austerity issue, is that as economies get wealthier, it becomes harder and harder to maintain growth. I'll give you just a quick example so you understand why that's so. From 1990 to 1995, the lumber industry, which is, again, a major industry in eastern Canada, to grow 3% had to cut down 1.5 million more trees than it did the year before, or the five-year period before. 1.5 million more trees. From 2005 to 2010, to grow at that same 3% rate, it had to cut down 2.5 million more trees. So the growth rate stayed the same, but the amount of trees that had to be cut down, grew significantly. Well, the same is true of automobiles. In other words, the automobile industry is going to grow 3% a year. That means more and more automobiles have to be produced and purchased. Same thing with cameras. Same thing with, again, virtually everything. So it gets harder and harder for banks, investors, et cetera, to realize a return on their money. Now, the question is then, all right, if they're not getting it from the economy, if the economy is getting more harder and harder to grow, where are they going to get their money? And our position is essentially they get it by taking it from somebody else. So while economists like to talk about austerity, what they're really talking about is taking. Now, let me give you another illustration to show you how essentially this works. What's happening now in Greece is a good example. Right now, Greece faces a major crisis that may come to a head in the next few days or so, where they owe a considerable amount of money, largely to German banks, and they don't have the money to repay it. Now, number one, how did Greece get into that situation? Well, it got into that situation because a lot of banks, particularly German banks, which happen to be flush with money, and of course, banks can't hold on to the money. They got to make it. They got to put it somewhere where it's earning interest. Lent Greece a lot of money for things such as the Olympics, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I think any reputable economist could have told you that it was absolutely impossible for the Greek economy to grow fast enough to repay those debts. Couldn't do it. And I think that's true, by the way, of all third world indebted countries. Nobody who knew anything about those countries could have expected them to grow enough to repay the debts, which, of course, they'd never been able to repay. Well, the question, the one thing the banks knew, though, in terms of Greece, that if they couldn't grow fast enough, they could take that money that they had due them from other places. And so essentially what's happened is that the European banks that lent this money to Greece are saying, well, Greece has to go on an austerity program. Well, by austerity, what that means is that the Greek banks now get to take from Greece money from other places. So, for example, they're taking it from pension funds. They've taken it from education. Money spent in education for Greece is plummeted, because of this. They take it from labor by laying off, hundreds of thousands of workers. They take it in the form of property by privatizing state assets in Greece. So when people talk about austerity, what they're really talking about is taking. Now, you had a good discussion. Robin Voss was on a few weeks ago talking about education and austerity in Canada. Well, essentially what's happened, there's not less money in Canada. There's more money in Canada. In fact, there's 4,000% more money in Canada now than it was in 1968. And so how can, given this amount of money, do you have to have reductions in education? Well, you have to have reductions in education because that money is being taken to, in effect, given to the 1% so that they can realize their return on capital that gets harder and harder to realize. And, when you look at Greece and what Greece is going through, I think it's not inaccurate to say that in some sense we're all Greek. Yeah. And at some point, virtually every country is going to face that problem. And the U.S., support for education is plummeted. Infrastructure is decaying. Money that, again, should be going to help the poor is drying up. Well, there's not less money in the United States, but what's happening is a greater percentage of it is going to, in effect, capital as opposed to, the public.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe just one more, way to think about this. people who talk about austerity like to use the metaphor of the household that's spending beyond its means, and now they've got to tighten their belt. Mm. And that's a completely inappropriate metaphor. I think if you want to use a household metaphor, imagine a family of 10 siblings, and one sibling is getting half of the income of the family. And if his or his income is ever threatened, he gets to take from the income of his other 9 brothers and sisters. If you want to use a household metaphor, that's far more accurate one than, you know, using the one of somebody spending beyond their means.
All right, out of time, gotta go. Have a good day. Bye.